Call this meeting to order. This is the work session of the mayor and council of the city of Bisbee, county of Cochise, and state of Arizona to be held on Tuesday, May 16th, 2017 at 5:30 in the Bisbee Municipal Building, 118 Arizona Street. Thank you. Ms. Williams, would you call the roll, please?
Councilmember Anna Klein?
Here.
Councilmember Joan Hanson?
Here.
Councilmember Frank Davis?
Here.
Mayor David Smith?
Present.
Councilmember Bill Higgins?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Douglas Dunn?
Here.
Councilmember Lindstrom? Richard J. Marsh, City Manager. Nina Williams, Deputy City Clerk. Britt Hanson, City Attorney.
Thank you. Do we have any phone calls or emails or other communications regarding non-attendance?
No, sir.
Thank you. Okay. Welcome, everyone. This is a work session, which means that the council will not be voting on any matters, but that this is presented to the council for educational purposes as well as to the audience, both live and on television. And there's one item to be looked at tonight, and I wanted to indicate that there's some misinformation present. I know that's shocking to me anyway. Deals have been struck to include how much money is going to be paid, how much water is going to be used, and all of these kind of things. And this meeting is for the purpose for the council to understand the concept that is being looked at and has been requested, not hard and fast data. If the council decides that they want to enter into negotiations regarding this concept, that is when we will then, at that point, start talking about how much affluent annually, how much that's going to cost, meaning how much the city will charge for that, and those types of things. So I just wanted to bring that up to the council as well as the audience that tonight we're talking about the concept. We're here to learn about this and the concept of this. And so with that, this presentation is by Holly Richter of the Nature Conservancy and is regarding acquiring Bisbee wastewater affluent to recharge the San Pedro River. And with that, I'd like to turn this over to Ms. Holly Richter, and thank you so much. Let me explain. We do have a call to the public. One is in case we have questions regarding a certain area. Perhaps Holly, we have Brad Edwards and Sharon Rock. Is this something you want to speak on before Ms. Richter or after Ms. Richter?
After.
Thank you, sir.
I was planning on doing it before.
Yeah. All right. And I apologize. I'm a little goofy here today, I guess. Ms. Richter, would you allow Sharon to speak real quick before? Call to the public before your presentation.
Absolutely. Then.
Thank you. I apologize for you jumping up and down. Ms. Sharon Rock.
Do I have 3 minutes?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Greetings, Mayor and Council. My name is Sharon Rock, and I live in Old Bisbee. I'd like to express my opposition to the possible sale of Bisbee's effluent water. Bisbee currently relies on pumped groundwater from wells near Naco to supply our water. Our effluent is currently sent to Greenbush Draw near those wells. As I recall from an earlier meeting on this subject, Arizona Water Company agrees that to a certain extent we're recycling our own water. In spite of doing this recycling, the Naco well levels are slowly dropping. So why would we choose to accelerate the lowering of the Naco wells? Water is the most valuable natural resource on the planet. Selling water, in my opinion, is foolhardy. But we've been told that this plan is to help increase surface flow in the San Pedro River, a noble endeavor. When the National Riparian Area was created in 1988, the Department of the Interior promised sufficient water to keep this rare riparian area alive. That amount of water is scheduled to be decided in federal court this November. This approaching adjudication has everyone with a vested interest in groundwater uneasy, namely Sierra Vista and Cochise County, which are key members of the CCRN. Pat Call, Cochise County Supervisor, refers to the adjudication of federal, a government water grab. There is total disregard for the river. There is a disconnect between the ostensible noble cause of the CCRN, which was a private organization for most of the time it's been in extant, and you couldn't get the records from it, and the water grab. So there's this disconnect. The bottom line is that without water, there's no development, and development means money. I think there's more going on with some of the members of the CCRN than meets the eye. For this reason, and the other I stated, I oppose the sale of Bisbee's effluent water. But if you choose to pursue the sale, I caution you to do so not until you have a legal assurance from the CCRN that they're not involved with swapping surface water for groundwater. The river needs both, and they are interconnected in ways that have been proven scientifically. There's no question about it anymore. And we need our water here in Bisbee.
All right. But thank you so much, Ms. Rock.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Ms. Rector, now, I apologize.
No worries. I think I need a clicker, though.
Great. Can we probably hit the middle light?
Yes. Thank you all for your interest in this topic tonight. I've worked for the Nature Conservancy for about 25 years on river conservation projects throughout the West. I'm a riparian ecologist by training. And water is, of course, the lifeblood of rivers, and particularly of streamside forests. And with my opening slide, there's a picture of the San Pedro on the right, and it's that very lush habitat that provides an amazing amount of places for wildlife, not only to live but to migrate. About 1 to 3 million birds every year use that green corridor to migrate between Central and South America and their summer habitats up in North America and Canada. So the migratory bird issue related to the San Pedro is perhaps its most famous value in terms of habitat, but of course there's all kinds of species that enjoy the San Pedro, and it was the first natural riparian conservation area designated in our country, which makes it a very special place. The thing that's so interesting about keeping a lush and vibrant habitat, like you see in that picture, healthy, is keeping the water available. And there are many things that we can do outside of that area that is managed by BLM that can help to sustain that ecosystem. And if there's one thing that I've learned after thinking about these kinds of issues for 20 years, it's that you have to think in a systems perspective. You have to understand things like the hydrologic cycle, like the way groundwater and surface water is connected. And some of these things are very complex. And I'm going to try not to make them too complicated tonight, but hit the highlights of what you need to know about the San Pedro and its water and what it means to stay healthy. And I have some really interesting science from that other people have worked on for years that I want to share with you. The first concept, though, is this idea of sustainability of water. And so this is actually just kind of a concept regarding water management that I think is very useful, in that we can think of using groundwater in a manner that can be maintained for an indefinite amount of time without causing either unacceptable environmental, economic, or social consequences. And what that really requires is a lot of balance, right? How do we meet the needs of a desert flowing river during an extended drought? How do we meet the needs of local communities that rely on stored groundwater that may have been there for hundreds or thousands of years and isn't renewable necessarily at the rates that we're using that at. These are all very complicated questions, but we do have a lot of ways to try to address them and to try to meet those needs simultaneously. And that's what some of the science that I'm going to talk about today is really aimed at. The Cochise Conservation and Recharge Network is basically just an agreement among the cities of Bisbee and Sierra Vista, Cochise County, the Hereford NRCD, and the Nature Conservancy. We're not a formal organization. We have no legal status. But we have signed a memorandum of understanding that says that we will work together towards this vision of a flowing river, the conservation of water, and a viable local economy, trying to balance the social, economic, environmental needs of water. And frankly, the Nature Conservancy's role in that conversation is to bring science that can help to inform decision-making. And the Conservancy is a nonprofit organization who prides itself on using science to inform decisions, and that's really our role within the CCRN as well. And the CCRN is, the members of that group have something in common, and that is that we implement specific projects. So there are, have been other groups like the Upper San Pedro Partnership, which has 21 member agencies over time, that has done a lot of science and different kinds of things. The CCRN is a smaller group with a much narrower focus of implementing projects that can contribute toward that vision. And I'm going to talk about the full suite of projects that we're working on implementing together. Again, just the list of the CCRN members joined together just by an MOU saying that we have this common vision and that we want to work together via projects. And I wish this was a little bigger for you to see in more detail. But on the right, it looks like a barcode. Imagine that that's the flow of the San Pedro River straightened out in sequential years. So that bar on the left actually represents 1999 and where the river was wet and where it was not in that. And you can see the San Pedro Riparian National Conservation Area outlined on the left. And so those different bars for every year from 1999 forward show where there was water in the river in that National Riparian Conservation Area each year. The thing that's really neat about this illustration is that you can see that there are large stretches of the river that flow continuously all year round every year, but there's some places in the river where the flows are breaking up. And this is actually citizen science information. You might have heard of the Wet-Dry Mapping Project. There's actually, this is a project that extends all the way from Mexico down the San Pedro all the way to the Gila River every year. And hundreds of volunteers go out with GPS units at the hottest, driest time of the year and map where the river remains flowing. So this is a data set that's been really important in understanding trends about the river and its flows. And what we've done is we've looked at that and we've said, well, there's obviously some breaks that are happening in the same place along the river every year, and it would be really nice to enhance flows and increase the flows in those areas. The Nature Conservancy worked with Fort Huachuca. They had actually a program to acquire lands for habitat and for buffer of sensitive areas, and we acquired some tracts right at those places, some tracts of land that were on the market and available, right where those lands, right where the flows of the river had fragmented. And we thought, well, for one thing, it'll be good that we don't increase pumping in these areas that are having less flow in the river. And for another thing, it'd be really great if we could put more water into the aquifer where it needs it the most. And so we, meaning the Nature Conservancy, again, we've got some funding from Fort Huachuca. We acquired some of these lands. They have since been transferred to Cochise County as CCRN project sites. What I will tell you about these sites is that we used actually computer models to help us understand the benefits of the groundwater in these sites. I'll talk a little bit more about that. I don't want to get into a lot of the science other than to tell you that the computer models that we did generate told us that those were the right places to, number one, not pump any more than you needed to because it had the most impact on the river being right next to it and in these areas where the flows are fragmenting. And number two, they'd be the very best places to put water back to the ground. So there are actually some green blobs on the left, which are the CCRN project sites. And I could go through naming them for you. There's basically six of them. Some of them are designed to recharge effluent, and one of them I'm sure many of you have actually been to, which is the Zaragoza Environmental Operations Park. That was a project that started way before the CCRN, but it created kind of a model and a concept for this aquifer recharge. And we actually learned a lot by monitoring the hydrology of that facility. We now understand there's a groundwater mound of very great extent that actually goes all the way to and past the river underground, where groundwater levels have risen from the recharge of the effluent that has been put in at that facility. So that was kind of an initial project that created the concept for this network of projects. There's another project that's already constructed down in Palominas, which you might have seen, that is on Palominas Road, just north of 92, which is a stormwater project that puts water back into the ground. This combination of putting both effluent and stormwater back into the ground created this opportunity, if you will, for this network of sites to increase and improve flows. So in terms of... So we asked ourselves, what would it take if we were to, what would it take on these six different sites, of which two are currently constructed, a third is under construction at the Lab Ranch and on the stormwater project, but what would it take to really fully blow out all six sites? How much water would it take to sustain the flows in the river and improve them where they're fragmented for the next 50, 75 years? How much would it take? So we worked with this computer model, we asked that question, we ran some simulations. These are some of the numbers that we came up with in terms of the amount of water that would have to be added at these sites to meet the goals of the river and to sustain those flows. They do not reflect any kind of available water supplies. Obviously, the EOP basins are already providing that water, and the Palominas recharge project is providing that water. The other numbers are numbers that we worked with this computer model to try to understand what would it take, and these are some of the numbers that we came up with. So here is the outline of BLM's Riparian National Conservation Area, and any of the places where you see the river turning blue means that flow is increasing in those reaches versus any of the areas that you see. If you see any of them turning orange or yellow, that means that the flow is decreasing. If you don't see anything on the river channel, that means it's staying the same. And so we asked the computer model, can you tell us in the years 2025, 2050, 2075, what does the flow in the river look like if we do no recharge projects? What's the future? Given all that we know, and remember, this is a very data-rich model with a lot of information contributed by a lot of people. It's the science that was developed by the Upper San Pedro Partnership, which is actually 21 member agencies, that took about 10 years to develop this information. That's quite a process. But it is a very robust tool. And basically what you see is that you, even if you turned off those projects that are currently operating, like the EOP, for example, the flows in the river actually, I don't think I have a pointer, but I'm not sure. The flows in the river, you can see the blue line on that 2025 picture on the left. You can see that their flows are actually on the increase, even at 2025, still responding from the recharge that's been added by EOP, even if you turned it off today. So there's this very much lag response in the river. When you put water into the ground, that's groundwater that slowly moves towards the river, helps the flows, but it takes a long time to get there. But you see those benefits diminishing, and by that last time slice in 2075 on the right, you can see that there are some reaches where the flows are either, they've stopped increasing as compared to 2003. This is all compared to 2003 conditions. Or they're actually really dewatering. And you can see down in the Palominas area, there's some areas that are turning yellow and orange. Certainly that's the Baba Kamari coming in from the left. And you see a big decrease in flows there. So that's the do nothing scenario, because we wanted to know what that looked like. And then we said, okay, so what we think would really help the river over this period of time, and really not only support it, but enhance those flows where they become fragmented at the six projects, this is what it looks like. And we see that there's actually benefits to the flows are persistent through 2075. And this is really encouraging news. And it means a lot in terms of the health of that streamside forest as well as the river itself. And it tells us that if we are very careful with how much water we put into the ground in just the right places, we can sustain flows with a somewhat reasonable amount of water. But again, no certainty that that water is available. I'm just saying this was kind of a what if we do, what if we don't comparison in terms of the flows over the coming decades. So let's talk about those projects that are in place right now. I mentioned before the Palominas Recharge Project. This is a picture of it shortly after construction. And it has what's called sheet flow, which means that there's dispersed stormwater moving over the ground, not necessarily in a channel. This is actually a constructed channel, though, that collected that sheet flow. The sheet flow is actually a real problem for the Palominas School and the adjoining neighbors, which I know can appreciate that even in the audience. But so what it did was it solved the flooding problem, but it also took that flood water, concentrated it, and put it in this constructed channel that has some very unique infrastructure in the base of the channel to get that water back into the ground very quickly and effectively. And so this was a test pilot stormwater project, trying to understand how to minimize the losses of stormwater in terms of evaporation and maximize getting it back into the ground to recharge the aquifer. This is a really interesting project and will inform additional stormwater projects to come that will probably be larger scale. Groundwater recharge, the effluent, we already mentioned the EOP. At EOP, there's actually 50 acres of the treatment wetlands, but 30 acres of the rapid infiltration basins that are the recharge basins that get that water back into the ground. And in between the wetlands and those infiltration basins, there's over 2,700 acre feet per year. And it's a very monumental project that has improved groundwater elevations literally for miles around its location. A lot of monitoring to understand exactly how the water moves underground and to document the response of the aquifer to this project. There was a lot that we learned from it. So now I'm going to launch into this idea of the possible use of effluent from the San Jose Wastewater Treatment Facility as an additional project, and one of those that could be included in this network. And again, I am only coming at this from a scientific perspective. I'm here to share with you what I know as a technical basis for this work. This is actually work that I contracted with a very good hydrologist by the name of Laurel Locker, who used the USGS groundwater model and asked some questions of it. And we tried to ask not only how this wastewater could help as part of this network of projects along the river, but also I know that there was a lot of interest, what would be the implications if that effluent was moved away from where it is? What are the groundwater implications at the well field in San Jose area? So anyway, I hope I do Laurel justice in presenting her results. This is a presentation, like I said, work contracted by the Conservancy. We asked Laurel to do this and to present this to the CCRN members in January, and this is the exact presentation that they got, but I tried to make it a little shorter. Okay. So her study area shown here, and of course Greenbrush Draw is on the current discharge site is on the right. The Lab Ranch extends along the international border over to the BLM Riparian Conservation Area. That is the proposed site for this potential recharge project, and we will talk a little bit more in detail about this, but that's just kind of the big picture look at the river and basically I think it's about 8 or 9 miles distance between those sites. The first thing that Laurel did when she wanted to use this simulation model to ask these specific questions was to make sure it was updated. And so what we did is we had her update the pumping records. I know that she worked with city staff very closely to understand how to get the very best data to make the model as up-to-date as it possibly could be, and to get those most recent pumping information from the well field, This is just a map showing the production wells in the vicinity of the San Jose Wastewater Treatment Facility. They were the production wells that were added and updated in terms of how much they actually had been pumping to the groundwater model so that it was as current as it possibly could be in terms of those well elevations and what the current status of them was. And of course, with any model, it's only as good as the data demand. So if you don't have the more current information as to the current conditions, of course, you can't project to the future. So this was
we don't have a pointer, where are landmarks to show us what roads are? Is that Capitol Highway going down the middle of the map or what?
Yeah, absolutely. So here is Highway 92, Knockle Highway. Here, this is the golf course. You can see some of the greens. And these are the different production wells in that area. These are actually City of Naco wells. But she went through and really made sure that all of those wells had the most recent information in terms of their current levels. Sorry, I wish the screen was a whole lot bigger. So this is obviously, sorry about the formatting, didn't quite cross over right when we imported the slideshow, but the wastewater treatment facility, this is just an aerial view. I know you guys are familiar with that. Obviously, it was replaced the old Bisbee wastewater treatment facilities, and it's discharged to Greenbrush Draw since 2006. So this was another aspect of updating the model, making sure that it understood how much had been recharged into the aquifer since 2006. And so we had to look at not only how much effluent was produced, but how much was actually recharged, because not all of it was recharged. Some of it was used for dust control by Freeport-McMoRan. So we needed to make sure that those numbers were accurate in terms of not only what was pumped out of the aquifer in recent years, but what's been put back in it. And so the annual production of effluent since 2006 ranged from 322 acre feet a year to 456 in terms of total production. This is actually a chart showing the annual effluent production, as well as how the part of it that was used by Freeport-McMoRan and the discharge from the San Jose wastewater treatment plant. So basically, you have the total effluent production is in the hollow lines. The blue lines are the recharge, and then the red lines are the FMI use every year. And it goes from 2006 up through 2014, and it just shows you that trend over time. And this, again, is a lot of information that we got on directly from the wastewater treatment plant operators and city staff working with Laura Locker, the consultant that we hired. The questions, sorry, I don't know what's with this formatting. These are the questions that we thought would be most important tonight, and I hope I get these right, because I want to be useful in terms of informing the decisions that you guys need to make. The first question was, how is recharging effluent in Greenbrush Draw currently affecting the local system? In other words, what's the benefit that you guys are getting from the recharge that is occurring right now? The second question is, what's the impact if you move that effluent recharge out of the Greenbrush, and what's the effect that it has on drinking water well levels and supplies? And then third is, how will recharging treated effluent efforts to draw affect riparian conditions, which means the streamside forest and the flows of the river? So those were kind of three big questions, and I'm going to run through them one at a time in terms of what our simulation models tell us. So the first thing to know is that recharge, again, is not only so this is actually the outfall of the wastewater treatment discharge right near the Naco Highway. And you probably drive past this all the time and don't even know it, but that is the place where it actually comes out of the system. And so when that water comes out of the outfall, two things can happen. Number one is that it can go into the ground and recharge the aquifer. But of course, there's always going to be some evapotranspiration loss. And evapotranspiration means that it's evaporation, just going down that ditch. But there also can be, used by plants, evapotranspiration means the water could be intercepted by plants as it's transported. So there's going to be some losses anytime you have an outfall like this. And so the question is, okay, so you can't really calculate what's the benefit of recharging in Greenbrush Draw unless you know these numbers. So We tried to work through those numbers. Laurel used a online program that actually shows evapotranspiration. It's kind of a Google Earth-like tool. And you can see on the left that she looked at what's the evapotranspiration and the loss of water through those processes in that area in June, and she compared it every month. These are just a couple of samples for you to look at. But there's one in August, and the big difference between June and August, because of course the monsoon starts, right? But this was just to give you a sense that if you go through the course of the year, you actually can figure out how much water is lost from evapotranspiration. Tools like this, and without getting into too much detail, then you can actually calculate, okay, if the amount of effluent was, the discharge was this much, we know what percent was lost to evapotranspiration by a tool like that. And her calculations came up with 30 acre feet per year. And so that's the estimated loss from evaporation that actually won't be recharged, but was effluent that evaporated. And what that actually means is that that number is somewhere, depending on how much effluent is produced, in that neighborhood of 7 to 20% of the effluent that's put into reverse pond every year. Okay, so these are, she just started to kind of bracket. So what that means is 7 to 20% was lost, the rest of it was recharged, and she put that in the model. So then she can get on to the next question about, well, so what's the impact if you're recharging that much, losing some to evaporation, you know, what's going to happen when you take it away? And quantifying that. And this is output from the model. Simulated head is just a fancy way of saying ground depth to groundwater at the Bisbee well field. And a couple things about this illustration. One is that there is a general declining trend, and this is just a prediction by the model from about 2008 to 2050. And there's a decreasing trend, but the important thing here to realize is that this is the trend whether you recharge or not. So there are four lines there, and you can't read the legend, but this actually shows with greenbrush draw recharge and without greenbrush recharge, either way, you do have a declining trend, but it's about 3 to 4 feet. And so what does that mean over the course of this year? So there's a difference in the lines. Some lines don't decrease as much as others, although they all decrease. I'm going to kind of break this down for you a little bit more here, so don't worry. This is probably a more helpful description of what the model showed. These are four of the major Arizona Water Company wells. First thing is, notice that they are different depths. So one is only 150 feet total. One's 221, one's 218. One's more than 1,000. Okay, so completely different depths. They also show the depth to water. This is in 1968. This one is in 1957. It kind of reflects the age of each well. This one is in 1990. And then it also has updated depths to water. So well number three, the depth to water is 120 feet in 2006. In this well, the depth to water is 109 feet. This well, 119. And this one is at the elevation 4,428. We don't know how many feet below the surface on that exact well. But what we can tell you is that the depth to water is in the vicinity of 109 to 120 feet below the surface in these production wells. What we can also tell you is that there has been a decline in every one of them. You can see that. But the additional decline, if you were to remove the effluent from that area and bring it to the river, the additional decline that you would see is 3 to 4 feet. Okay, so yes, there is an additional decline in the water levels over time, but when you look at the scale of the overall decline, the depth of the water to begin with, it's not that big of a number. And that's the best estimate that this groundwater model can give us in terms of the impacts of moving the effluent to the river.
This is a similar illustration to the other one that I showed you that, again, shows the declining rates of groundwater elevation over time. This is the elevation. But again, it is just the difference, you know, of a couple of feet with and without the reach. Okay, moving on to the third question, which is, what's the effect that it will have on the base flow of the San Pedro River? What's the benefits of moving it from the river's perspective? So, this is kind of interesting. This white box wasn't here when I emailed it. Basically, though, what this gives you is the location of Greenbrush Draw, taking the effluent about 8 or 9 miles over to the Horseshoe Draw site, which you can tell is one of the tributaries of the San Pedro. It's still outside of the National Conservation Area. That's the boundary of the National Conservation Area. The site location would be on the private Ladd Ranch. There is an existing project there that's being built right now that is actually a detention basin to reduce erosion. And there's going to be a ribbon cutting for that project in a couple of weeks. We kind of think of that as kind of like that's our first phase of the project is the stormwater erosion control project. But in terms of the actual recharge benefits to the river, what the best science tells us is that it would take a lot more water to actually have the benefits that we need for this reach of the river, which if you go back to that barcode illustration that I had that showed all the breaks and the flows, and we'll talk about that again in a minute. This area is actually all the way to the Hereford Bridge. This is probably the most fragmented flows in this area, in the reach that needs the most help. So how much help would this project give the river is kind of what we're asking the computer to model to simulate for us at this point. And here we go, back to this. How much water does it take to meet this need? We believed it was around 400 acre feet. We ran this model to show exactly what 400 acre feet would do if we put it in at the Ladd Ranch, which is right here. This is the Palomino Stormwater Project right across the river from that location. So the other thing I want you to look at is a little bit more carefully about the pattern here in terms of the river flows. One of the biggest breaks of the river is right at the international border. That's a really big break right at the border. There is no flow until you get, maybe a mile or so north. There's not a lot of reliable flow at the border itself. So we ran the simulation to say, okay, what if we did put about 400 acre feet in at the Ladd Ranch? But we also asked the question of, okay, well, what's the difference between adding 400 acre feet, which is this one? So this just shows, again, kind of the decline if you do nothing in groundwater elevations, with the groundwater over time to 2050, due to the declining trend in the groundwater levels. If you were to add 200 acre feet, how much would that help? And that's this line. Or 300 acre feet, which is this line, or 400 acre feet. Because we thought it would be interesting to see, you know, how much does it really take to make a difference? And so you can look at that graph and say, well, more is better. I guess we kind of knew that. But the real, I think, benefit of using a tool like this is that it can tell you spatially where it gets better. And so here's your 200 acre foot scenario. And so here's the Ladd Ranch again. And this green area actually shows you where there is benefits that would help the river. How far do those benefits extend? And it's interesting because, you know, when you recharge over here, it helps here, and it even helps down here. So the way water moves underground is very much influenced by if it's sand or gravel or clay, and it moves in mysterious ways underground very slowly, ways that we can't see. That's why we have models like this, because we've entered a lot of soils data and a lot of the hydrogeology that helps the model better predict where the water is going to go by when. So at 200 acre feet, these are the benefits that we see by 2050. And basically what that means, and this is the outline of the National Conservation Area here, is that about 630 acres of that floodplain and the streamside areas are benefited from 200 acre feet, and it's mostly the eastern edge, again, with the boundary here, the river itself more in the center over here. There's not that much benefit down here where we needed the most that first mile along the Mexico border. It's more outside of the riparian conservation area to the east. 300 acre feet, we start to see the blob, the green blob, getting bigger. We start to see it moving into the center of the river, closer to the border. Benefits about 1,260 acres of the National Conservation Area in terms of groundwater levels. And so it's a partial benefit, certainly more than the first one down by the border. The 400 acre foot scenario benefits over 1,900 acres. It fully addresses this dry reach. So that groundwater extends through the National Conservation Area fully and addresses the borderland area. And provides almost continuous improvement up towards the Hereford Bridge. So there's just a little bit of gap in here, a little bit of gap in here. But again, it provides, as you would expect, you know, more water, more benefit. But we wanted to know how much more and where, and that's why we ran these scenarios. That's probably one of the more important outcomes of all this work. Okay, and this just shows as kind of in a table, it simulates that, or it summarizes those three pictures you just saw. 200 acre feet, about 4.2 miles of the river in terms of its actual river flows benefit, 630 acres of the forest. And again, this isn't just about getting a trickle of water down the channel. This is, I mean, think about it. What we're really doing is talking about providing water for a streamside forest, and that means is that the roots of those trees need to be able to reach groundwater. So 630 acres of the streamside forest would benefit under 200 acre feet, and that number again going up to 910 with if you were to recharge 400 acre feet. A very direct and positive relationship, the number of areas affected versus the acre feet you recharge per year. Again, it's what we would expect, but until you really ask this model to produce exactly, you know, what's going to happen, it can help to confirm that for us. So I'm just going to summarize the those questions that I started off at the beginning of the presentation with. First one, how is recharging effluent currently affecting the local system? What we know now is that between 322 and 456 acre feet of very high quality effluent has been discharged to Greenbrush Draw each year since it began. In addition to recharge, Freeport has used up to 250 acre feet of effluent on any given year. So not all of it's recharged, but certainly a big proportion of it has been. On average, it's about 360 acre feet every year so far that's been discharged. And about 80 to 93% of the effluent actually recharges the aquifer, and that goes back to that fact of 7 to 20% is used by plants or evaporated from the channel. So that just gives you a sense of the efficiency of the recharge, the amount of the recharge, and how the whole system has been operating since its inception. And they're impressive, good numbers. Question number two, what impact would moving it the effluent out of the draw, and what would be the impact to the drinking water supply and the wells? Again, I think an understanding of the depth to groundwater in that area is important. It's right now about 120 or 130 feet. Simulations show that groundwater levels at the well field are expected to decrease by 40 feet, even if the recharge continued, by the year 2050. Simulations also show that ground level waters would decrease an additional 3 or 4 feet at the well field, and about 6 to 7 feet at the Greenbrush Draw outlet as a result of moving the recharge location. So, you know, it's a little bit different at the wells than at the actual outlet, but it's in that order of magnitude. And then a 3 to 4 foot simulated decrease in groundwater, like we're saying, would occur if you move the effluent. Basically, it amounts to a maximum of about 2.7% change in a well, if you were to look at it in that way. Question three, how will recharging 400 acre feet of effluent at Horseshoe Draw affect riparian conditions and base flow? And again, those pictures of the green blobs probably tell the story the best, that by 2050 that the groundwater levels underlying about 1,900 acres of floodplain are predicted to increase by a half a foot or more, and that can make a big difference in terms of access for a forest to water supplies. and that more than 5 miles of the river are predicted to see increased flows in terms of the actual river flows, 4.4 miles by 2050. So that is kind of the state of our science, and I know there's a lot of assumptions, and believe me, years and years of work behind this that I can't get into tonight. I tried to just hit the things that I think would be of most interest to you. I just wanted to close with this slide, though. It actually represents some of the different places I work. That's the Upper San Pedro on the upper left. Probably looks real familiar to you. The Verde River on the lower left, northern Arizona, a real important perennial river. And believe it or not, this is the Colorado River on the right. And a lot of people don't realize that today the Colorado River does not flow to the ocean. Mm-hmm. Our major artery of the West no longer even has the water to make it to the sea. And this is actually an experimental release of water down the Colorado River. This is the leading edge with scientists monitoring the water coming down the dry Colorado River, and it actually did make it to the ocean, and it was kind of a trial water management event to see if it could happen again. I only put these pictures in and end my talk with them because I want you to realize that river conservation in the West, in the arid West, during a time of extended drought and increasing water demands, is becoming very complex, very complicated, and very tough. And yet, from just a wildlife and ecological values perspective, we have some of the very finest values in the state and the West in our backyard. It's very easy to take that for granted, but we have a lot at stake, and we're not the only ones that have a river on the brink. And I think there's going to be a lot of tough decisions about water and rivers required around the West and potentially beyond in the coming years. I will stop there.
Thank you. Council? Questions of Ms. Richter? Ms. Richter, I'll start with just a couple of things.
Did you want her to...
Yes, I would. Thanks.
I also have questions.
You and I have met a couple of times about this mm-hmm. issue. So quite frankly, I believe I know the answers to a couple questions. But I think that others should know those answers. And so one would be the impact of this proposition on Fort Huachuca as to its welfare.
Hmm. Well, again, I'm going to reiterate that I'm a scientist. I am not well-versed in the legal requirements of Fort Huachuca or its water needs or some of the regulatory aspects of it. I will, though, offer up that Fort Huachuca has been a huge partner in funding a lot of good work to sustain the flows in the San Pedro River. And certainly we're pivotal partners in the acquisition of these recharge tracks. And I leave it to others to ask or answer the question as terms of the regulatory legal benefits that they might kind of accrue from these projects. But I will tell you that they have played a big part in getting us this far towards making a difference for the San Pedro.
Thank you. Second question is, there has been certainly discussion with the fact that this proposition is actually nothing more than attempting to put water into the river to benefit a future housing development outside of Benson. Can you address that?
Mm-hmm. That's a technical question I'd be glad to answer. So our computer model, which again, if anyone wants additional information on that, I'd be very glad to go into that at any time with anyone. But it was very explicit on my slideshow exactly where the benefits are accrued from this project. That's the only location where we can really determine their direct benefits to anything. And I would also suggest that the villages of Veneto is many miles downstream, and that at some point groundwater, yes, it does travel down gradient. At some point in the very distant future, maybe there might be some really remote benefit at some very relatively minor level, but I will tell you that these projects are designed to enhance flows where that map of the barcode breaks in flows exist. And we spent a whole lot of years understanding where the river needs the help the most. Hundreds of people helped us understand where the river needs the help the most, and that's exactly what these projects are designed to do.
Thank you, ma'am. Ms. Hansen?
Thank you, and thank you for asking that question, because if you didn't, I was going to. There is the one of the things that people have been talking to me about has been the pipeline itself that is proposed to be built, taking the water to Horseshoe Draw, which is 8 to 9 miles. And the cost of that, even though it's not Bisbee's cost, is the cost of the county, is my understanding.
So one thing that I would say is that all of the work done by the CCRN, the projects that we've implemented to date, have been, I think, really unique and frankly exciting in that they've been public-private partnerships. And so we have been the recipients of some foundations that very much support river conservation that have made some major investments in these projects. And I don't want to speculate as to where the funding will come from for any part of any one project, because frankly we don't have the funding for these projects in hand. But I will tell you that I think the only way that they will get built is a really creative partnerships going forward, just like we've done in the past, with private donors, private foundations, conservation interests, as well as the collaboration and participation of our public partners. No one entity is going to cover the cost of these. And yet, together, there can be creative ways to make them happen. And I think that's what we've done to date. And we certainly can discuss how that's been done with every project that's been built, including EOP in the past. It's always been a partnership, with many people coming to the table to make it possible.
And the effect on the wells and on the green brush draw that you were showing, that is based on the pipeline, or there being a pipeline to Horseshoe Draw.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Thank
mm-hmm.
you.
I might just add that we have not done all of the detailed engineering about how the pipeline would be built, because there is not a certainty that there's water that might be available to transport it. Yeah. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. You're,
yeah. It's
as we've discussed, you, this is why you've approached us, is the first step. Mm-hmm. To say whether we would be willing or not, in order to go the next step to find out exactly how much that pipeline costs. And
exactly.
And of course, the point when Ms. Hansen said that it isn't Bisbee, but it's the county, in fact, it's us.
Well, it is.
Yeah. That on at least the public part of the partnership would be borne by all of us as taxpayers. So I just was mentioning
well,
that.
I didn't want to mention that.
Well, what the heck. Ms. Klein, do you have any questions at this point?
Yeah, I just think it's very interesting, so thank you for your presentation.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
What the Sierra Vista's partnership in this, as far as their wastewater?
Mm-hmm. So, they entered into an agreement back in, the EOP went online around 2002. And that facility was funded, again, multiple sources. It was the Arizona Water Protection Fund, so there was some state money, again, that was aimed at helping things like rivers that was available. There was some Bureau of Reclamation funding, so a federal grant that helped to pay for that recharge facility. I think that was probably, although I don't entirely recall, but I believe that was, the Bureau of Reclamation is in the Department of the Interior, as is the BLM, so they're a sister agency to BLM, so here was a project that actually helped to sustain flows in a federal project right next door. They had a grant program that was available to help pay for that facility. Obviously, part of the expense was borne by the city itself. But it was, a collaborative kind of project even back then. And part of the requirements for that collaboration was that it was very well monitored in terms of its benefits and impacts. And we're really thankful for that because it really helped us, again, understand how something like this can work and to use that concept to basically create a network of different projects that could do a similar thing over time.
Mr. Higgins?
I see that the city of Sierra Vista, they recharge approximately 2,700 acres a year, and what we're expecting from Bisbee is approximately 400 acre feet. This 400 acre feet would help, from here to, from Horseshoe Draw to the river, it's going to be a green belt, more or less, as a result of the discharge there. Mm-hmm. You show that green section on the map next to the river.
And maybe that green was actually a little misleading. It's not. What that green blob showed is the areas where groundwater will rise underground. It doesn't mean that basically there's new vegetation. It just means that there's increasing groundwater levels in that area.
And is part of that land on the Ladd Ranch itself?
Yes. So some of the benefits of the recharge, if the recharge project is actually on the Ladd Ranch, obviously the groundwater would benefit on part of the Ladd Ranch, but it would spill out, if you will, onto other lands as well as the federal lands.
So that water underground at the Ladd Ranch, does that belong to the Ladd Ranch, or does that belong to... Who owns that water?
Yeah, no. So legally, no one owns that water. Groundwater is kind of it's a very complicated thing in terms of groundwater code in Arizona, but it's no one's and everyone's.
That's what I've always heard, that out west, that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting over.
Right, yeah. No, it's not like there's water rights associated with the water that's put back into the ground where somebody owns it. And the same thing with Sierra Vista's effluent, for that matter, yeah. It's put back into the ground, and it travels in different places under different ownership.
So the water that's... That Sierra Vista is putting back in the ground is affecting, this would be up the river, is affecting areas up the river from Sierra Vista.
Yeah.
And this would be like attacking the problem below that, mm-hmm. and no way that this is going to affect the flow coming across the border at all.
No.
I mean, that's not going to help with that.
Well, what it's going to help is it's going to help sustain the forest that's along the river at the border, and it will increase flows north of the border for, I think I said 4.5 miles or something. But I can tell you exactly where the flows will increase and where the groundwater will rise and by how much, according to how much you put in at the recharge facility. Yeah. And it is confusing because it flows north, and so it's up north downstream. Mm-hmm. And groundwater actually flows in a somewhat northerly direction, kind of at a 45 angle towards the river.
Groundwater does all.
Yeah, but it depends on if there's sand or gravel or clay, and that's why we have these predictive models that help us figure that all out.
Mayor Pro Tem.
What, if any, would be the influence or impact on the sulfate plume that we have here in Bisbee?
Mm-hmm. That wasn't a question that we asked the consultant to directly address. It's probably a fairly complex question. It could be addressed. I don't frankly know without asking the model.
Yep. Anything else at this point? Okay. I'm going to ask... Again, I'll ask Mr. Brad Edwards to step up. He asked, you have your 3 minutes, Mr. Edwards. This is the call to the public that he has to put off.
My name is Brad Edwards. I live in Warren. I'm a property owner in Warren and year-round resident. I'm curious as far as the amount of information that she gave. So much of it was dependent upon off-the-shelf computer modeling software that she got. One size fits all, apparently. I would like to have computer modeling that I would have a little bit more trust in. To give an example, meteorology. I mean, 20 years ago, they thought, meteorologists would thought that the computer models would only need about another 10 years or so worth of tweaking and it would work fine. Well, we've been finding that the sophistication of computer models is far greater than we ever thought, and I have a feeling that this system might be a little bit too complex for off-the-shelf modeling. The best way to determine what the natural environment, a very complex system, is going to behave is to actually work with the natural environment. Now, unfortunately, it would be best to do an experiment, but unfortunately, the experiment would be very costly because it would require the building of the pipeline. But maybe we can look. There may have been a lot of other rivers throughout the Southwest where a lot of this stuff has been going on before now. Perhaps the geology department, hydrology department at the U of A might look at some computer modeling that was done in the past and to see whether those computer models actually turned out to be duplicated by the real system once the system was actually tried. And I would like the city of Bisbee to look a little bit, a lot more carefully before they commit themselves to the expense of this sort of thing. One thing, the two, Mexico is an unknown factor. We don't know, I don't think a lot of the raw data that she plugged even into the computer model is based upon what's been going on in Mexico and what might happen in the future. She was able to see this extrapolation that's going on, a nice smooth curve going down. We're not sure whether that's going to actually be the case because so much of it depends on what's going on in Mexico, which is the headwaters of the San Pedro. There's an awful lot going on that might affect it. She saw that there was a break where a lot of water was taken out of the San Pedro right at the international boundary. Now, a lot of that, the groundwater probably surfaced up many miles down the way. So when Mexican consumption of the water was no longer a factor. So we don't know what the situation might be in the future. We ought to try to get more data about what the future of consumption of San Pedro water in Mexico is going to be before you invest an awful lot. One other item, the last item I want to mention is she mentions the breakups and the bar graphs she showed. That was taken at lowest flow. And this recharge is going to be going on year-round. It seems to me as though if the recharge could be arranged to just go be flowing into the San Pedro at the times of lowest flow rate, we might be able to build that up at just the point where it's needed the most instead of having to recharge year-round. So I think that there are various many different scenarios that could be tried before the city should make a decision on what they want to do here. So that's my
question.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Edwards. Ms. Richter, I'm curious. You didn't do the modeling. Is it an FDS model or a linear model or do you know?
It's a three-dimensional mod flow model that was created by the USGS. The Upper San Pedro Partnership was formed in 1998 to build a groundwater model that 21 agencies could agree upon. It took them 8 years to do it, and that this is the model. It's a custom-built model. It encompasses the Sierra Vista sub-watershed in the U.S. It also encompasses the Mexico sub-basin. So it does include, and there were data shared across the border so that we had the most current information available in Mexico. So it was a model that literally took 8 years to build. The USGS, it's the state-of-the-art science. There's a publication that was the highest level reviewed type of publication that the GS does that was published describing the model, and I'd be glad to provide that citation. I don't have it memorized. But there is a whole document that documents the establishment and construction of the model.
Thank you.
Could I ask one question?
Just a minute, Mr. Hayes. Anybody, any other in the council? I'm going to allow a couple of questions from the audience. We're not going to let this go on too long. Mr. Edwards, you may stand and ask your question, sir.
Sure. I'll address it to the council. I guess that would be most appropriate.
It would, sir.
Find out if maybe information could be obtained about how much this model that she's been used has been tested against observations of the real systems that the computer model has been modeling to see whether the observations of these systems really agree carefully with what the computer model has been predicting.
Sure. Thank you. I assume that there's a analytic it's a long day, I'm sorry. that we do have that, what he said.
very important, and it's model calibration. And so that whole idea of, again, taking your empirical data that's collected in the field, that's real information about what's actually happening, and plugging it back into the model refines its accuracy over time. And that's exactly what we have been doing. In fact, the next update to the model is due in late June, and we will be running the same scenarios to see how much difference there is with the most current information put back into the model. So you're absolutely right. That's an important cycle.
Great. Thank you, ma'am. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Please stand and ask your question. Fair enough. That is something that the council would certainly discuss, because I think we're all aware of that as a habitat. It's questions that I've talked to Ms. Richter about, but that depends, as I understand from her answers, that depends on how much water, if we were to enter into an agreement, how much water would go into a pipeline and how much water would go into the Greenbrush draw. Does that make sense? So the impact is dependent on those two figures, so we can't really answer that now, other than that has been looked at and would be addressed by the council at that proper time. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am, would you stand?
Yeah. So obviously there isn't enough water in the Southwest in this area for everything. And I understand that the water table's been going down over the years. So I guess my question is, you know, every place needs water. I mean, the San Pedro River needs water, you know, all the aquifers, you know. So it's like, what do you do? How do you balance that? And what would we lose by, you know, diverting water to the San Pedro from where it's going now? And would we end up, as you asked, you know, would it affect the sulfur plume? You know, I mean, because I know someone already who lives off Airport Road who can't use the water because of the sulfur plume. So that's not very far from here.
I can assure, thank you. I can assure you that some of these questions have been thought of, have been asked, and prior to the council making some type of a decision, I would request input from others that might have some of that information. Freeport MacMoran may be able to provide some information regarding the sulfur plume versus water table. Arizona Water might be able to assist us with some of that. So we will be using other resources also to try to make as informed decision as possible. This isn't subject fits all situation. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Patricia Worth from Warren, and my question is, I have two questions. Who draws all from the San Pedro at the moment? What entities, what populace, if any, and who in the future may be drawn from the San Pedro?
Okay.
If you know.
Well, this is a really good question. So we in the San Pedro watershed all use groundwater, right? None of us divert river to use. We don't have that kind of water. We pump it out of the ground. The way the groundwater works, just in the kind of the highest, roughest sense, is that groundwater all moves towards the river underground. And sometimes it can take a year to get there, or a day to get there, or 500 years to get there. But every gallon that we pump, any of us in this basin, we are pumping water that over some period of time would have moved towards the river to help sustain its flows. So who uses the San Pedro's River? All of us. But some of our pumps intercept water that would have made it there in 500 years. Some of our pumps like myself, who lives near the river, would have intercepted water that would have made it there tomorrow or in 3 days, right? So, does that help?
I might want to add this, something that I didn't realize when I first moved to Bisbee, because we're on the other side of the Mule Mountains for the most part. Didn't feel connected at all to the San Pedro River until somebody told me, oh, but the water you're drinking out of your tap and showering with is coming out of the San Pedro sub-watershed. So all of us, you know, from that are drawing on Arizona Water Company, and I think Naco's wells are also in the sub-watershed, are using water. Now, as Holly mentioned, it matters where you are in terms of how close a relationship you have to the river itself. Over time, it could take where the water is in the Greenbrush, being dumped in the Greenbrush draw now, that is going into the same aquifer that supports the river. It's just that it takes a really long time for it to get there to support the river. Whereas the purpose of moving this water and recharging it closer to the river is because it's got a more direct, immediate impact on the river. Over 1,000 years of time, maybe it wouldn't make any difference whether you do it or not. But the river is in danger in a lot shorter period of time than 1,000 years, and that's one of the reasons of the project. And I also wanted to mention, since I'm already talking to the microphone, that I think there's, and I don't know where it came from, but some suspicion that all of us have been putting a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into not just this project, but all these conservation easements and everything else we've done over the 8-10 years that, or at least my part has been 8-10 years, is we're somehow doing this so that we're you know, trading it to developers, and it's not true at all. We're all doing it because we're trying to keep the river alive, and as we've all seen from Holly's slide and our own personal experiences, all the rivers in the Southwest are drying up. We're lucky enough to have one that hasn't dried up, and we're trying to keep it alive, not just the next year, but the 2025, 2050, and 2075, and it's really hard, and it takes things, extraordinary measures like this to try to do that.
Thanks, sir. Yes, sir.
I live off the valley, the other valley. I was one of the authors of the act that made the San Pedro a federal property. I have served on many of the committees in many years, which led to the San Pedro Partnership. The reason we started the San Pedro campaign to put the river in a federal problem was because we perceived that the population growth in the Sierra District really was very critical. It was primarily a matter of overpumping, and the issue of overpumping in the San Pedro Basin has been the main issue ever since. What we are doing with this kind of project is minimal compared to the overpumping. It is an after-the-fact attempt to plug a leak that we are not really plugging. Fact, I suspect that no matter what we do with this project or similar recharge projects, unless we stop the growth of population and pumping in the basin, we're still going to. My question for you all would be, is the CCRM doing anything to stop more development?
What I will tell you is that the several thousand of acres that are these recharge projects that were funded by Fort Huachuca, every one of them has a conservation easement on it that precludes future development. Every one of them was a residential development that had been platted and was under, the Bella Vista is one of probably the largest proposed development that was slated for Sierra Vista's future. It connects basically the city of Sierra Vista all the way to the river to Fort Huachuca. Same thing with the Mansco property, much smaller subdivision development proposal for Palomina. Same thing with the Riverstone track. When the market crashed, those were on the market, and they were some of them in bankruptcy. But they were all slated for development, and that development has now been permanently precluded by conservation easements that the Nature Conservancy still holds today, even though the lands have been transferred to Cochise County. What the conservation easement allows is that it allows the development of aquifer recharge projects that can help the river, and very limited facilities for, you know, operation of those kinds of things. But I do think that precluding pumping in those key locations is, if I didn't emphasize it in my slideshow, I apologize, but it's as important as putting water back in the ground, because when you pump, again, right next to the river, and especially, you know, in these key tracks that have large tributaries in them like Ramsey and Carr and Coyote Wash, these are really important zones for the protection of the hydrology. And I do think that that's a huge contribution that the CCRN membership has provided in terms of conservation.
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Last question.
I think it's true that...
Yes. Only because you're rather soft-spoken. Thank you.
Sharon Rock again. I believe it's true that any wells that were drilled post-1988 in the certain part of the watershed that supply the river, the people were warned that they couldn't, that if they drilled those wells, they could be capped if there wasn't enough water to meet the reserve needs of the Sprinka. So I don't know how significant it is that of the things you were talking about Fort Huachuca. I mean, that's all good. I'm grateful for it. But there's also a legal precedent there that already covers that, supposedly. Just wanted to respond to that. But I believe you said that there was a declining trend in groundwater in the river area from the models from 2012 to 2050 if the recharge doesn't take place. You said that, right? Can you explain why there would be that decline in the groundwater if there isn't a recharge?
I think one thing that's really important to clarify is that there are legal aspects related to water, and I think you were referring to the Gila adjudication process and the Federal Reserve right that is being adjudicated as part of that. That is basically a water rights claim by the federal government for the Sprinka and settling how much water it needs. That is very different than... I just want to be clear, there's differences in terms of what hydrologists call wet water versus paper water. And so how much water is actually there now or how much will actually be there in the future might be very different than what's legally appropriable. And so my work is all about physically what's out there right now and what it would take to keep it or enhance it. Regardless of the law, regardless of legal water rights.
For what?
For those periods that I discussed, yeah. I just wanted to clarify that having the legal right to water and it being there could be two different things. And so what I've been talking about tonight is the physical reality of what really is out there and how we could get more wet water to be in the right places at the right time. And that might be very different than any of the legal conversations. So, but your question about why the river would not do well without recharge. Right now, we have maps of groundwater depths throughout Sierra Vista sub-watershed, and there is a cone of depression that's regional in extent in the San Pedro River Valley. And frankly, that cone of depression started back in 1940 when the centrifugal pumps were first used in our wells to extract water more efficiently. So it gets back to this groundwater levels sink when we pump it faster than it's replaced. There is a lot of data, and again, I can provide information in terms of the publications that summarize this if anybody really wants to know more about it, kind of at the regional scale. There is a what they call cone of depression in the San Pedro River Valley. That started when we started pumping in 1940. It has grown in extent. It's moving very slowly and expanding towards the river. What this recharge will do is stop that cone of depression, which is basically the groundwater that's been drawn down from pumping, from reaching the river. If it reaches the river will go dry. We have seen this in the Santa Cruz. We've seen it throughout the desert Southwest. It's why flowing rivers are so rare, because in most places, that cone of depression from our pumping has already reached those rivers, hasn't reached the San Pedro yet. This aquifer recharge network would create, think of it as almost a wall of groundwater right next to the river, so that cone of depression doesn't expand and hit it. But if every one of us was to leave the San Pedro River Valley this very moment, get in our cars and leave, that cone of depression will hit the river over time. It's slowly, very slowly moving, and it will take a while to actually get to the river, but you don't have to pump one more drop of water for it to be too late to do nothing. It's too late to do nothing because it is expanding. It will expand to basically meet the river, even if we were all to leave today.
Thank you, Mr. Richter.
Gets to that lagged effect of Thank you. Pumping that, and recharge.
It's next time we'll try to get somebody who's passionate about the subject. Don't be sorry, Ms. Richter. I thank you very, very much for your expertise, for your time, and we certainly will be meeting on this subject down the road. And so thank you so much, and thank you those in the audience that had questions and those for attending. May I have a motion to adjourn for 5 minutes? We have a motion to adjourn.
Second.
We have a second. Those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We stand adjourned until 7 o'clock.